once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to another extremely exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, where we will talk about such things as personal finance and balancing your bank accounts. But very really? Exciting. No, we probably won't talk about that. So it's very exciting, though. I mean, I just told them it'd be exciting. Try to tell them how. Some people may not find that exciting.
We can talk about doing your income taxes.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good one. Well, it's exciting when you do it wrong. Now, there's probably more excitement than I would ever want to actually have. Just from the sound of it. Yeah. So this hour we've got a bunch to talk about.
And if you want to join with us, you can email us at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Better yet, Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com.
Yes, that's preferred.
Yeah.
We can both get it. All right. So one of the things that we touched on last hour, but really haven't touched on for very long, is what's going on with the debt ceiling and why does it matter? What is a debt ceiling, and if it rains, will it leak?
Yeah.
Yes, it will leak, and there will be water stains on it. It will be, no, a debt ceiling. All right, so we're going to rewind. This is, we touched on it last hour at the beginning, middle of the market report. One of the worries that seems to be coming out for some reason is that people that own or own bonds that have been loaned to, money's been loaned to the government, or people who get paychecks from the government, something weird has been occurring where they actually want to get paid. I know that's weird. It just seems like a lot to ask for. Ask not what your country can do for you. But at the same time, they agreed to pay people. The conversation that's going on in Washington, there are webs within webs within webs, and that's not always the case in Washington. When you look at Washington, usually there's some really like crayon-inspired strategies on how to get bills passed. Well, both sides of the argument, the Democrats and the Republicans right now, are using like some extreme strategy to try to get bills passed or not passed. The extreme strategy that they're using may or may not actually work, though. So what am I talking about? There's a massive budget coming through that is likely to get passed that includes a lot of spending that the Republicans don't want. Well, there was a pretty big budget that was passed by the Republicans that included a lot of spending that the Democrats didn't want. Oh, I know. It's weird. It's like they don't want the same things. Well, that's what we're talking about right now. And there are enough votes in the Senate to stop most bills from being passed no matter what. So there's enough votes on either side to stop most bills. If the Democrats don't like it, it won't pass. If the Republicans don't like it, it won't pass. But there's a different kind of bill that has to do with the budget. When you're passing a bill that has to do with the budget, the rules are different. You don't get to filibuster. It gets passed on a simple majority because when they made the rules, they had this assumption that that would somehow stop a government shutdown. That rule was made to stop government shutdowns. Right? Have you seen it being effective to stop?
No. Nope.
Well, I have. I've seen it effect. It's more effective than it isn't. In that there have been a lot of votes that have passed with a simple majority that would not have passed if it had a filibuster. Obamacare was passed through this system, through a budgetary increase system. Yeah. So was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
So each administration passes, each party, when they're in power, pass bills that, if it were a filibuster, would never get passed.
Right. So this budget includes a lot of stuff like protecting the ecology, greenhouse type stuff, and other things having to do with more of the Democrats' agenda. Well, it's always something. That's the point that we're trying to make here. And the go-to tool to stop it is the debt ceiling. Why would you use the debt ceiling to stop a budget? Because the reality, what is the debt ceiling? The debt ceiling is, let's kind of roll back in time a little bit. Years ago, we won't mention dates specifically because it's not important for your day-to-day life unless you just really like being down to the exact. We used to pass a budget, and at the same time, if borrowing was required for that budget, each part that required borrowing would have a separate law passed allowing the borrowing, allowing the Treasury Department to issue bonds, to borrow money to pay for what Congress said, this is our budget, we've agreed to the budget, we're going to pay for this budget using some borrowed money, this is how we're going to get the borrowed money. Eventually, Congress said, hey, we don't like that, that's twice the work. We're having to work too much here, we have to have a sister act, wait, that's a movie, we have to have a brother, no, it's just a different bill that goes along in parallel that's allowing borrow. We're just going to tell the Treasury Department to borrow as much as they need to pay for what we've already agreed on spending. Well, wait, we're going to put some limitations on that, because while we may have agreed on spending it, what if the spending is just going really fast? Well, my answer to that would be, well, just don't agree on spending that then. Well, the debt ceiling is the cap that Congress put on the Treasury Department's ability to issue new debt to pay for things that they've already agreed to spend. The Congress said, we must spend this. Treasury Department, find ways of getting it. So we keep coming to the debt ceiling after we've already passed the spending. And this is, you look pregnant with thought. So please join the labor.
Right now, the Republicans are in the minority and the Democrats are in the majority. So we're going to talk about it that way. It reverses. But here's the key. The money, the Congress passes a law. It's a law that says, Treasury, you will spend this money. And they did. They passed several laws last year, for example, that we need to borrow money for this year.
Right.
And I'm not hammering down on any one party, but last year
it's when all the Republicans, parties. Let's just hammer Congress in general.
When the Republicans were in power and they are the ones who had the majority, they passed some laws to give a lot of money away. And it helped the economy tremendously, in my opinion. Now comes the time when the Treasury has to borrow money to pay for that. And it's like Congress said, this is a law. If you break the law, you go to jail. I don't necessarily think they put the Secretary of Treasury in jail, but the point is,
there were threats made at multiple times to do that at different government shutdowns. So
yeah, they won't let the Secretary of the Treasury or the President sequester money and not spend the money that's been authorized by, that's been required by law. But now comes the time when the credit card limit has to be raised to cover the spending that was made by law, because these new bills, the ones that are being argued about right now, have not passed into law. So that's not, the current debt ceiling has nothing to do with the new bills that are being argued about.
Yeah.
I think, this is just my opinion, I don't care what party's doing it, threatening the full faith and confidence of the United States behind its debt, behind its bonds, threatening people who are in the military or people who are on Social Security with not being paid in order to keep a bill from passing.
You may disagree with the bill, but
disingenuous. Now, if you don't want a bill to pass, I'm sorry. Whoever's in the majority is going to pass certain bills, and the other side's not going to like it.
And if you don't like it enough,
the whole thing up, the threat to blow the whole thing up because somebody's passing a bill you don't like.
Yeah.
Nobody that I can think of would think that was a good idea except a politician.
It is called brinksmanship, and it's very much like if you did this in your marriage, you would be getting the car out and saying, I'm going to drive it off the cliff if you don't do what I want, or I'm not paying any of our bills because I want to make sure we go to Hawaii and not San Jose.
Right.
And that's what's happening here. And if this were at a restaurant, it'd be a lot easier to understand, except that there's a weird mix-up in the middle of this. No restaurant would let this happen, and that is that you sit down at the restaurant, you get your menu, you order from the menu, and you order whatever you want. And then you eat the food. And then they show up with the bill, and you say, nope. I believe that it is not a good idea to borrow more money than you make. So I'm not going to pay this. Well, that's a really good ethical stance. I kind of do agree that you shouldn't be borrowing more money than you can pay back. But you shouldn't buy the thing that you need the borrowed money for and then tell them you're not going to pay them. So no restaurant would allow that to happen because it gets one step more confusing. Because Congress changes, what happens is that the group that comes to sit at the table gets the menu out, opens it up, orders whatever they want to eat, eats it, then they have a little conference, and some of them stay, and some of them were replaced by other people that didn't get to eat it. But they're still obligated to pay for it. So this is the difference in Congress. When a Congress gets removed and replaced by somebody else, they're still obligated to pay for the bills that were racked up from the prior Congress. And right now, that's bills that were racked up by a Republican Congress expected to be paid by the Democrats, but the Republicans don't want to pay for the bills that the Republicans racked up because the Democrats want to buy more stuff. You can switch the Democrats and the Republicans at any point in the last decade and say it's the Democrats doing it now or the Republicans doing it now. It's just a fact of life in Washington. And what it does is it creates a very bad environment for the economy and for businesses and for people that expect to get paid by the U.S. government. It's not a good idea. It's dysfunctional.
And this is the point. It takes 60 votes to pass an extension on the debt ceiling.
It only takes 51 votes to pass the budget.
It takes 51 votes to spend more money. But it takes 60 votes to agree to pay for it.
To actually pay for the money that you agreed to spend.
And
wait a minute. At the restaurant, this is an even better one. You just had a nice dinner. They bring you the check and they say, oh, let me call my wife. I want to make sure she agrees that I pay for this. No, sir, you owe this. Well, let me make sure she agrees first. She's not even here.
There's lots of arguments can be made. And I've gotten a couple of letters from John Carter, our representative, about why he didn't vote for the continuing resolution, why he is objecting to raising the debt ceiling. It boils down to the fact that he doesn't like some bills that the majority passed.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. The majority is the majority. They pass bills. When you get in the majority, you're going to pass bills they don't like too.
And you'll be emailing us about how bad they are for not raising the debt ceiling to pay for the stuff that you want.
I just don't think even threatening to shut down the government and not pay bills that the government has agreed to pay, including paychecks to the military.
It's like the only tool that's available to the minority right now. It's the only, because we used to have a filibuster that covered more things. We used to have a filibuster that covered appointments by the president for lots of posts, cabinet to judges. And man, posts and cabinets, that sounds like I'm talking about a furniture shop. That is what's happening, and it's worrisome because we're talking about obligations that represent a lot of money, and the last government shutdown wasn't over the debt ceiling. It was over the budget, and it hurt. I know people got the money that they were owed by the government, but it was late. It's not cool to have a job that you've already done your work for and then not get paid for it and then be late on your rent. And then the government saying to the landlord, don't worry about it. You're going to get paid sometime because the government's going to do it. That sounds like communism. That is not what I want. And it sounds like the Republicans are kind of endorsing it. I don't think this is correct. When I say dysfunctional, I don't care if it's the Democrats that do it. And you can listen back to our recordings from when the Democrats did it. And how we were saying this is not the right way to do it. And for some reason, Congress is not listening to our radio program. We have been saying this with a great deal of effort, but for some reason they're not listening. I don't know. Do you think that DC? I mean, it's within our listening radius online. I don't know why they're not listening to us.
Yeah, well, but probably don't like us criticizing them.
Yeah, that's probably the point. But that's the thing is that we'll get better ratings. More people will listen to us if we complain about them.
I don't know.
Well, that's bad news, sells, right? We should talk about catastrophic events that could happen if Congress doesn't stop being dysfunctional.
Yeah. There's a lot of arguments around it. May I change the subject?
Please.
There was an article that came out, if you're a subscriber to, see if I can figure out who Reckonthaler Report. If you happen to be a subscriber to that, there's some interesting.
Which report?
Reckonthaler Report.
Okay.
John Reckonthaler. He wrote about something I thought was very appropriate. He said there are three major investing mistakes every investor should avoid. The first one is aiming too high, and I completely agree. The people who invested in Evergrande's bonds, and there are apparently a lot of people in the United States who invested in Evergrande bonds. The product, they were promising anywhere from 8.5% to 11.5% a year. That's absurd. That's just not going to happen. And people looked at that and said, this is a big Chinese company, and I'll put my money there, and I'll get a lot of money. Allianz has a fund called the Structured Alpha 1000, which is a private equity fund.
Which we're not recommending in any way.
No, absolutely. We're recommending against it. It has a goal of beating the return on cash, in other words, money market funds, by 10% a year while generating returns in times of rising or falling equity markets. When you get something like that, no matter how thoroughly it's promised, and in the many, many years, like 40 years I have been doing this now, I have seen it happen so many times where, say, you know, we're really the smart guys and we can get you in on the insider deal and we can get you 10% a year and it's almost guaranteed, there's no risk. In an environment where treasuries are paying 10-year treasury is paying 1.4%. That's frankly totally impossible. You can't get there from here. You know, you hear about people who, through luck, invested in Bitcoin or something at the right time. By the way, you hear about the people who invested in Bitcoin at the right time. You don't hear about when they got out.
Yeah. It's kind of like going to Vegas. You hear, how'd you do in Vegas? Well, I won a lot of money. Did you bring it home?
No, because I lost a lot of money.
I lost it later, but I won a lot of money. I'm telling you.
and it's just, it's not going to, you're not going to get anywhere that way. Slow and steady works. Well-diversified works. The second point that Reckonthaler makes, and I think it's a very good one, it's a bad idea to accept complexity.
Just
if you're investing in something you don't understand and can't understand, you probably are investing in the wrong thing. I don't remember, the Fidelity Magellan Fund was run by
Peter Lynch.
And he said something a long time ago that's very, very good. He said, never invest in anything you can't describe to a 10-year-old on a Big Chief tablet with a crayon. And that makes perfectly good sense to me. When something is absurd, it may make money for a while, but at some point it's going to lose money. Historically, at least, it always has. I can't tell you about the future. It's going to lose money in a hurry. And the scams, whatever they are, sometimes the scams are perfectly legal. Evergrande is a big Ponzi scheme. It's a legal Ponzi scheme being run in China. But then again, so was Enron, and so were a lot of other things in the United States. Real estate deals, commonly privately held real estate deals, private equity funds, private funds like this, sometimes are legal Ponzi schemes. And you need to stay away from them. If somebody, and right now, some of the advertisements I get, and I haven't dug into the specific product, I get advertisements from annuity companies saying guaranteed 8.5% a year.
Yeah.
No, Well, if you dig deeper and you have some background, you find out that
what they're guaranteeing isn't what you think they are.
Well, not only is it not what you think you are, you find out that across the board, annuity companies across the United States right now are selling those contracts. After you invest in a contract, you say, I got this contract. Then they sell it away to somebody else. And they sell it away to somebody else because, very frankly, they've looked at the way the bond market is structured that they have to invest in and the way the economy is running and saying, we've made a promise. We've guaranteed a return that we don't think we'll be able to maintain for 30 years if somebody lives for 30 years. And we'll get rid of that contract now. We'll sell it off to somebody else. And right now, like 40% of the annuity contracts that have been that are in the United States today, if you own an annuity contract, are owned by private equity firms now, not by insurance companies. That's a little bit scary. And the change is going on faster and faster and faster. The principal, which is a major insurance company in the United States, is getting out of the life insurance and annuity business and selling all their stuff off, very frankly, because they think they'll lose a lot of money on it in the future and it might take them under. Well, somebody bought it and it's not going to work, and you're holding the contract 20 years from now, you got a problem.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that every annuity contract is bad and everything is bad, but when they promise a return that is absurd, that can't, you look at the guaranteed return from the government, you look at the return on CDs, and you say, that's a little too high to be true. It almost certainly is too high to be true. The mistake number three, and I think it's important, is flying blind.
Well, I think particularly if you're a pilot, that's a bad idea. Just saying. I mean, I think there should be some rules. The FAA should be involved here. Unless you've got really good autopilot flying blind, no.
Well, flying on instruments is good, but you have to have a qualified instrument.
Well, that's not flying blind. That's flying with instruments.
Well, yeah. The point that he made, and I think it's very, very good, is if you have an investment that's not reporting regularly on what they own and what their returns are, and you don't know what you own and what the returns are, you are in need of some help. That's not to say that everybody who owns mutual funds and everybody who owns an investment portfolio understands everything that's going on in the investment portfolio. But if you don't understand everything that's going on in your investment portfolio, it's important that you hire somebody who works solely for you, which is a fiduciary, not somebody who works for a big company that sells stuff, and say, what is this and how does it work and why is it working or is it not working? Is it likely to continue to work?
Yeah, I've run into, you mentioned these variable annuities and the annuity contracts. And I have run into quite a lot of that lately where people have their IRA in a variable annuity. And they may have a great guarantee on there somewhere, but I've yet to meet someone who actually understands the guarantee that they're paying for. It doesn't mean that people don't understand the guarantees. It just means that I haven't met somebody who owns one who understands it. And that's not good because the guarantee is rarely on what they think it is. It's a different kind of guarantee than what they think it is. It's guaranteeing something that they don't think they need a guarantee for, and they're paying money for it.
A variable annuity fluctuates with the market.
Right.
And if the market got low enough that your reasonable withdrawal rate doesn't work anymore, how is the company that is part of the market going to be able to make good on its guarantee?
Right. And this is the thing that you know, usually these variable annuities, and we're not talking bad about all variable annuities. There are no load variable annuities or very low expense variable annuities. There's a lot of stuff out there to look at, but they represent a very small percentage of the variable annuity market. There's a lot of variable annuities out there that just simply don't make sense for the people that have them. There's some that make sense for the people that have them. They're just rarer, especially if there's an IRA involved. The guarantee is usually not on the principal that you own Although a lot of people think it's, hey, this can't go down because it's guaranteed. That's a different kind of annuity, and those are different dangers. The guarantees generally on how much you can take out of the portfolio per year. But the only reason you would use that guarantee is if your market, if the market was so badly damaged, so low. But if you use the guarantee, so would everybody else that owns the guarantee. And that means that the insurance company would have to come up with a bunch of money while the market's down to pay for it. And while it's an insurance company, maintaining that guarantee for a long length of time when the market has really seriously tanked generally puts insurance companies out of business. So that, go ahead.
I want to emphasize something. There's a very good reason to use a variable annuity.
Yeah, yeah, very good. There's lots of good reasons for it.
It's, well, the principal reason is to defer taxes.
Yeah.
You don't, if you have a regular set of funds or regular portfolio, you get phantom income every year and you have to pay taxes on it whether you take any money out or not. If you put the money in a variable annuity, and it, there's more complexity to it than this. There's capital gains rates and all kinds of things that have to be calculated in. But if you put the money in a variable annuity and it's, then you don't pay the taxes on it until you actually take it out, and you only pay taxes on the profit as you take it out.
So you've deferred now, taxes on your gains, which is a good reason to own a variable annuity. Go ahead.
So if you own a variable annuity to defer to the future, there's two things that are important. One, what's the expense ratio in the variable annuity? Is it really, really low, or is it really, really high? Secondly, what are the investment options that are offered? Are there a lot of them, or just a few?
In that first one, I'm going to put a subset. How quickly can I get my money out without it costing me money to get my money out? I
mean, there it is.
Because a lot of times,
get your money out for next to nothing.
Yeah, a lot of times they'll tack these massive surrender charges that represent a huge portion of your assets for a decade. Sometimes it's only for 7 years. That's all, where my money is not available to me because it's being used to back expense. Well, if it's a long-term investment, you should be comfortable with that, sir. Well, no, I'm not comfortable with you owning my money for 7 years and me waiting to get it back after I pay it to you. And that's the point you should be looking at. If you have a massive surrender charge that lasts, I mean, we don't like surrender charges, period. We don't like to see them even for 1 year. And those are available in out there. You just have to do the research. Why most people don't have those is because those ones with big, long surrender charge periods pay the person that sells them a lot more to sell them. When the expenses are higher internally, the reason why more people have high expense variable annuity is because the person that sold it to them made more money selling that one than the one that's called no load, because you don't get paid on a no load. Anyway, I'm probably beating your subject a little harder than I should. You go ahead.
Well, the important thing is to understand what you have and to not be afraid of whoever is advising you. And understand why you have it. If you have a variable annuity because you filled up your 401k and your IRAs and you want to defer taxes and only pay taxes on what you take out, so it's a retirement account. That's the purpose.
But you don't get to defer the money that you put into it, just the gains on the money.
Right. You want to defer the taxes on the gains for a long period of time and take it out slowly, then a no-load, low-expense variable annuity is probably a useful thing. If there's a guarantee on it, we guarantee you'll be able to take out this much money a year. Who makes the guarantee? Well, the company does. What happens if the company goes under?
So check their credit rating, number one. Well, number two, check their co-insurance. Are other insurance companies offering to help? Are they being paid to help in the event that this insurance company has some problems?
From personal experience, I can tell you that insurance companies, even if they've been around 100 years, do not last forever. I mean, the principal has been around a long time, but they're selling off all the contracts. So if you have a life insurance contract or a Voya is another one that's doing it right now, by the way, or a annuity contract, it's being sold to somebody else. And the contract is still in place, but the guarantor is not the person who you researched when you did your credit check to see if this company can afford to make its payments into the future. Understand what you've got. Now, if you determine that, I'm going to entrust my money to this insurance company because it's good, And I believe they'll be able to pay into the future. And you've made a conscious decision to do so. That makes sense. Otherwise, and it's important. Another thing it's important to recognize, and I realize this is really unpopular among insurance agents and among some people. Insurance funds, like when you have a fixed annuity and they guarantee you'll pay you a certain amount of money, are not backed by the FDIC. They're not backed by any federal agency. They're not backed by the federal government. And I realize it's been a really long time since insurance companies started going under. But I've been in the business long enough. When I first started coming into the investment business, people were fleeing insurance companies and variable annuities because interest rates had risen very significantly in the late 70s and early 80s. And insurance companies were dropping like flies.
So that this is something when we look at a rising interest rate environment to be aware of coming forward.
And some of the people who put money in annuities or life insurance policies with these insurance companies got back 30 to 50 cents on the dollar. And it took them 10 years to get that back. Now, insurance agents don't like to talk about that. And they said, this company's been around for a long time, but that really doesn't say anything.
And we're not trying to scare you away from investing. We're asking that you take the time to do the research that you need to do to make sure that you don't hurt yourself, because it's kind of like power tools. I want my kids to learn how to do stuff with power tools. I have power tools. I want them to be able to use. I have a CNC. If you don't know what that is, it's like a robot power tool. It's pretty cool. I have table saw. I've got a chop saw. But I don't want my kids to learn how to do it willy-nilly. Yeah, all right, go on in there. The red button is the power button. Just go figure it out. No, I don't want that. And I don't want them to be investing with that little amount of knowledge. Here you go. You got some money. Go for it. Go for it. It's fine. You'll figure it out. No, it hurts to figure it out that way. Go ahead.
Did you change the subject here? The Federal Reserve there's a couple of things that are back page, small print news this week that I think are very important. One of them was the fact that the Federal Reserve had another meeting, and there was a press conference after the meeting, but in light of the Evergrande debacle and the Congress fight and everything else, it didn't make headlines. But the chairman of the Federal Reserve signaled very strongly, and now on a majority of the members of the Federal Reserve, the voting members, have signaled that they're going to reduce their buying of bonds in the open market in the near future, and they're going to continue and probably have it done by the middle of 2022, and they'll cut it off. Sometime in late 2022 or early 2023 is the best estimate right now. Interest rates, the Federal Reserve is going to start raising short-term interest rates. Now that they're going to try to keep the Treasury curve positive, which means longer-term interest rates will rise too. It's not a good idea to try to predict in the short-term interest rates, but it's a good idea to recognize when you're in a bull market or in a bear market for bonds. And the bull market for bonds ended last year. We are in a bear market for bonds, and if you've got a bond portfolio and you look at your value, your market value of your bonds right now, if they're anything other than very short-term bonds, you're going to see that it's fallen this year. And the Federal Reserve just announced interest rates are going up over the next several years. Very clearly, when interest rates go up, bonds go down. So if you have something that's interest rate dependent, like refinancing or buying a house, or there's a lot of other things that are interest rate dependent, or you have an interest in bonds or you have bonds, the Federal Reserve, which is the biggest gorilla in the room, actually monetarily the biggest gorilla in the world, has said, we anticipate interest rates rising over the next several years, and we are going to try to make it happen if nothing goes terribly wrong. There is a signal that's loud and clear. If you're a bondholder, if you're looking at bonds, if you're in a bond fund, if you're looking at borrowing money to do something long-term, there is a loud and clear signal that should be in your headline, and you should be very, very cognizant of that and be very, very aware of it and have a plan for dealing with it. And that was my blurb on that.
Well done.
We can talk about the LEI now if you'd like.
Yeah.
Leah.
The Leah. There is an index that we find more important almost than any of the others. We don't report on it very often, but we watch it. It's only released once a month. And it's the index of leading economic indicators. So it should be ILEI, but it's just called leading economic indicators, LEI. And what is it? Well, if you've ever been to Decatur, Illinois, if you've been in there, then you're in Decatur. And if you're I'm sorry. No, that's not what that is. I'm sorry. you said for me to talk about it. I mean, all I'm saying is you should have known when you handed it up. It's an index of things like housing starts and stuff that's looking forward to commitments that have already been made in the economy that will cause growth. So a housing start is one of those things. It's one of the few things that has the biggest result. A custom house is the biggest result in the economy because lots of loans are made both at the contractor level and at the, and there's multiple loans that are generally made at the homeowner level. And so there's lots of money that changes hands. And a housing start, if we've got a lot of housing starts, that means lots of money is going to change hands into the future. And each time it does that, someone is likely to be making profits and someone is likely to be receiving what they wanted to buy. This is the imagery in the future of growth. Go ahead. You say?
The Conference Board Leading Economic Index for the U.S. was up 0.9% in August.
That's for a one-month period. That's
1 month period.
Huge. It's month to month.
So far this year, including August, obviously, it's risen at a rate of 13.1% annually. Now, what does it mean? The leading economic indicators from the Conference Board have very consistently given us at least 6 months warning before we entered a recession as far back as the 1980s when they first started it. They've never missed a recession. Now, they've given a couple of false alarms. And in 2019, the leading economic indicators dipped and stayed down. And we said, there's a recession coming in 2020. It's pretty clear. The leading economic indicators are telling us this. The yield curve is telling us this. Now, what I want to know, this is the big question of the day.
Conspiracy theory.
How did the yield curve and the leading economic indicators know that the COVID pandemic was coming?
And our answer to that is it didn't know, but a recession was due anyway. This recession is actually the reaction to the recession by the government, by the Federal Reserve, and the depth of it means that what we were predicting, and the two of us on the radio since 2017 were looking at 2020 as a recession year. There are lots of indicators that were telling us, hey, this is coming. This is when it's when we're thinking of it. We didn't have a clue that there would be a global pandemic, but all the other pieces were laid up there. We were growing at absolutely the fastest speed we could, and things were breaking, and we weren't having time to fix them. Those are all things that lead to recessions over time. Well, the way this one occurred with so much violence at the beginning, I mean, violence being not real violence, but actual speed and vigor, this crazy recession causing basically a lockdown on the planet for a while. And then the response to it took what would have been likely a mild recession and made it a big recession that we fired all of our recession guns on at the same time and caused it to be the shortest lived recession in the history of the United States. So, whoa. We've had a lot of growth coming out of that recession and expect more. And all of that's important to know. We're not out of the woods yet, and we got to play some commercials. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. We can talk more about where we are in history. I think that's important to understand when we get back. And do you have some things that you wanted to talk about when we get back?
Oh, yeah. I've got five or six things. That's all right.
20 or 30 little things. Yeah. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, we have email addresses available at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important announcements. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. And
this is Jeff McClure.
Together we are bald.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, the leading economic indicators that we were talking about, there's also a coincident economic indicator and a lagging economic indicator.
Oh, that second one is just a coincidental one. You don't really.
Yeah.
Coincident means happening alongside.
The lagging economic indicator is pretty low. The coincident is growing, but slowly. It's the leading economic indicators that are growing quickly. What does that mean? That means that our sense of where we are in the economy right now probably doesn't indicate that we're growing very fast. If you just are looking around and that's called coincident. When you see things, if you think back to where we were over the last several months, you may conclude also that we're not growing very fast and maybe there's problems. The leading economic indicators are the ones that consistently over time have risen before the economy takes off. And the Conference Board is looking at a 6.6% annual growth rate in the second quarter for the GDP after increasing 6.3% in the first quarter and saying we're going to have a good year. And I tend to agree with them. The Delta variant is the other thing I want to talk about.
Good idea. It is, well, we say the largest gorilla in the world is the Federal Reserve. COVID is the elephant. And the gorillas are trying to herd the elephants at this point, but the elephants are bigger.
Right now in the United States, over the last week, 1,123 people average per day were dying of COVID. 28 died in Bell County. In the last week,
Bell County is Central Texas. That's where our broadcast location is.
This is much higher than it was even a few months ago. The average death per day in the United States was down in the 300 range back in June. We're up at 1,123 right now. This is serious business in the United States. People are dying. And it's having a distinct effect. One of the General Mills is having trouble getting the raw materials they need to make food, and there's a result, and they're having to pay premium prices to get the raw materials they need to make the food that goes on the grocery shelf. And they're slow in getting it there, which means you may see some gaps on the grocery shelf. And they said the principal problem they're running into, now this is strictly in the United States. They're buying oats and wheat, things like that in the United States. There's a shortage of truck drivers. Why is there a shortage of truck drivers? Well, if you go dig, the American Trucking Association indicates that only 3.5% of truckers got vaccinated. And there's a lot of sick truckers right now. And truckers are dying at an unusually high rate. So there's a shortage of truck drivers in the United States to haul the grain around. This type of thing is going on across the nation. It gets bigger around the world. You probably noticed that prices have gone up on a lot of things. The rest of the world, with the exception of some places in Europe right now and Israel, have chosen to fight the COVID pandemic by isolation and tracking. They very carefully track whoever got the disease, see who they came in contact with, isolate them, and that's cool. And if it gets to be too many people, they just shut the whole area down. That worked in the original COVID, but it is not working for the Delta variant. The Delta variant moves faster than the tracking can work. As a result, we're getting outbreaks in China. We're getting outbreaks in Singapore. We're getting outbreaks. Vietnam is in a world of hurt. Much of the country is shut down right now, and we get a lot of stuff from Vietnam. A lot of components are made. Malaysia's had to shut down sections, whole sections of their country. Why? Because their hospitals are overfull. People are dying on the streets from COVID. This is a problem that's going to continue for some time. The United States still leads the world in the number of deaths per 100,000, and that's not a good thing. But our approach has kept our economy running pretty fast. It is hurting economies around the rest of the world, and in the end, it's slowing our growth down, and that's just a reality we're going to have to live with for some time, probably. But it's serious business, and I think there's a lot of people who are tired of fighting it. They're tired of wearing masks. They're tired of social distancing. It's still a problem, and it's still hurting the economy.
I would say that's everyone is tired of it. You can't not be tired. I mean, you can still do it enthusiastically, but everybody's tired.
Well, we're all tired of it, but some people have stopped doing it. Some people are treating it like it's all gone away and there's no problem. And I keep hearing about people one removed from me. In other words, somebody that we know has had family members or friends of theirs die from COVID. I've only had a couple of people that I know that have died, one that got extremely ill and is still ill after many, many months.
I know quite a bit more who have passed at this point.
And it is a terrible thing. I guess I know one person who's died personally. But it is a real thing. And it's really affecting the economy. And there's two issues, obviously. One is we would love you to take personal responsibility and not be spreading the disease, because there are people who are spreading the disease, even vaccinated, who don't know they're spreading the disease. And the other thing is get used to it, because it's going to be around for a while. It isn't going away in the immediate future. We thought by this time of year, it would be behind us and we would be back to normal and everything would be cool. Not so. It's something we're going to have to live with for some time.
Yeah, I know. There are ways that it could have been put behind us, but that would have included everyone getting the vaccine when they had the opportunity and just wiping it out across the planet. Now, I recommend that those of you that are listening now, go back to our webpage and go back to March and April and June, May and June of last year, and listen to what we were saying about how long we would have to vaccinate, that this was a forever thing because we just don't have the ability to vaccinate the planet anymore, which means that we're going to have booster shots forever. And I still hear in the media talking about this, something that no epidemiologists are saying anymore. The epidemiologists are all looking at the practical issue of getting people vaccinated and recognize this isn't going to happen. We're not getting enough people vaccinated, which means it's going to mutate and we're going to have booster shots forever. Just know that that's going to happen, and that masks and booster shots may be part of our lives forever.
Well, just like the flu shot, it's going to be around for a long time, forever. And by the way, it's a good idea if you're susceptible, if you need it, to get your flu shot starting, I think, next month they're available.
Yeah.
And that's important. It's just one of those things we have to learn to live with and carry on. But it also means we need to continue to take precautions as much as they're a problem, because people are still dying from it. And young people, we've just run across cases where young people that we know of in their 20s and 30s are dying of COVID. And this is a terrible thing. And I just hope that we can get around this. And people say, well, it's like the flu. It's not that big a thing. Folks, in the United States alone, we've had 685,389 deaths from COVID. Just COVID. That's not estimated deaths. That's not probable deaths. We've had, and I heard a person, a professional who works in that area, make a forecast that I think probably is true. We will eventually see over 1 million Americans die from COVID.
Yeah, I don't, from my perspective, I don't think that's going to be in doubt. We still don't have it under control. And there's a lot of people that aren't going to be vaccinated. And if that's the case, it's going to be around a long, 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 long time. So I don't know that we're going to continue to keep a count. In 20 years, are we going to have a running total of everybody that's ever died of COVID? I think the metrics are going to change because it's going to be here forever.
Yeah, well, it's real. It's something we need to learn to live with and stop fighting. And we need to take precautions to keep from spreading it to the best of our ability.
We got to thank
other things.
Thank you.
There's
for
a lot
Philip.
Of children.
Thanks. Oh. Thanks, Philip. He says, yes, I'm weird. Thanks for making my Sunday better. That's even weirder than normal.
Making what day better?
Sunday. That's the weird part, I think. He said, okay. Enjoyed your program today. Thanks, Philip. We enjoyed that you listened. It made us feel good that you enjoyed
it. Yes. We had one person listening. And we're about out of time for this Saturday, the first broadcast in autumn in 2021, a momentous day. And if you'd like to contact us off the air and talk about money management, because we do wealth management for well-off people with good-sized portfolios, you can call us locally. We have voicemail on the weekends and regular phone and real people answer. We don't have a phone tree during the week. 254-947-1111.
Or you can reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com if you're lazy like me and just want four letters instead of a lot. On that page, we've got newsletters that you can sign up for or read. You can listen to our radio program going back lots of years. You can also go to any podcast provider for that. Just look for TPWC. You can also contact us directly at Jeff or Jake at TPWC.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.